ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, fall has started here, and we're still having warm weather, so it's totally unique. Tonight we're going to have a very interesting conversation with some individuals, but before we get that, Denise, do you have an update?
Yes, we're still asking people to call up to the Senate, as we talked about last week, on the Senate Bill 951, which is the Caregiver Extension Bill. We need to particularly, you know, push Senator Burr, who's a Republican, and we need to get co-sponsors on the Senate side on their phone calls to the House. We want to initiate, to introduce the mirror bill, the exact same bill that the Senate has on the House side, that it cut down the time. So that's our big announcement. Keep on that. We have a Research Advisory Committee meeting for Guffaw Illness coming up on October 28th, 29th in D.C. at the VA headquarters, and we shall see how things change. Probably six of the 12 will not be there. They'll be replaced. The ones that are left are working on a report, and then they'll be replaced. So, people, you need to speak up about what's happened to the RAC. It was supposed to be an independent-type organization. And I think the VA Secretary Shinseki changing it is not going to be what we wanted. And we had worked hard to get to where we were with outstanding reports in 04 and 08, and then an IOM report, Volume 9, I believe it was, that said this was real. The neurological work could be done and treatment could be found if we had the government commitment to get it done. So please stand up for both of those items. They're critically important. Talk to your senators and reps about the Senate Caregiver Bill, Senate Bill 851, and the situation with the Research Advisory Committee. And if you need any info, just get on Facebook to Denise Nichols, message me, and I'll provide you information.
Yeah, it's also up on the archives for Warrior Connection, also with all the phone numbers.
Right.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, Denise has talked about this. We talked about incredible casualty numbers as a result of all our military operations. We have over 300,000 now from Desert Storm alone. We're looking at over 1 million from our Operation Iraqi Freedom. And all this stuff was triggered on September 11th of 2001. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to talk about that. Jim, are you with us tonight? Jim Fetzer? Kevin, are you there? Okay, hopefully they'll be coming in. Well, we want to go on a little bit and have a little bit of discussion of what has all transpired. One of the things that everybody seems to avoid wanting to talk about is the events on September 11th of 2001. And on that morning, when everything started, I was responding overnight to inquiries working with the United Nations on the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions throughout the Balkans and throughout the Middle East. And we'd been working on that from some time, trying to get all the health and environmental effects taken care of. And as I sat there watching that day, everything started happening, and I sent a message up to the United Nations, Karen Parker, and she responded back. Everybody was warned warned about everything happening. So it started transpiring on that day. One of the responsibilities I had was back at another time, so I had the responsibility for the U.S. Army of training the Newark Police and Fire Department Emergency Services Unit on weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, and all of this counterterrorism stuff. So we knew they were at least had some minimal training on all this stuff. Well, obviously, we had a thing in our hearts for all those guys as that thing started transpiring that day. Now, Denise, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay. Kevin, are you there? Jim? Okay. Well, hopefully our guests will be calling in. We had a real interesting symposium at the University of Illinois down here in Urbana, Illinois, at the Urbana Public Library a week ago. And during this symposium, what the questions are is what actually happened on September 11th of 2001. Well, because of the responsibilities I had knowing other individuals involved in all this stuff, after it all happened, I became very good friends with Willie Rodriguez. And Willie Rodriguez, you can go to the Internet and pull it all up. Willie Rodriguez was the man with the master key to the building, the World Trade Center. He had got to work late that day, and so he didn't go up to the eat his breakfast all the way up in the top. And as he got in there, what started happening all of a sudden is there were explosions in the sub-basement 3 and 4, which is very frightening to think about all this stuff happening. And this is before either aircraft hit. And so they were already bringing the casualties out that morning and trying to work with the casualties and everything else. Willie then led the rescues up there, led the police and the fire as they responded. They were already responding to the previous explosions before either aircraft hit, and then they were starting to lead the rescue. So Willie had the responsibility then for leading the police and the fire up into the structures and opening doors and trying to get people out. And he made quite a few trips in and out of the building trying to actually rescue everybody and getting everybody in and out. And you can go to Willie's website and find out what happened that day and talk, you know, find out firsthand from the individuals that are there. It's substantially different than what we are given to believe. And that is just really bothersome. And Willie's been on this program before and everything else, which is really nice. And he worked in the World Trade Center for 19 years prior to all this stuff. And 911, he initially rescued 15 persons from World Trade Center. And he was the only person on site with a master key. He bravely led the firefighters up the stairwell and locking doors as they ascended and aiding to get everybody out. He went in and out of the building the whole time, getting everything down. And from the time of the impact, and he was the last man to come out of the building alive as the structure blew up and came on down. Jim, are you with us by chance yet? Kevin? Okay. Well, I guess we'll just continue on a little bit more. Some years later, what we do know is that's happening that day, and as we look at everything, the police and the fire, as we talk to those guys, most of the police and fire are having serious medical problems from the same thing. And they're mirroring what we know as Gulf War illness. So we have all of the same stuff involved in this stuff, all of the byproducts from explosions, explosives, all the byproducts from the destruction of infrastructure and everything else. So the health effects on the New York Police and Fire Department and all the civilians that were in there is just devastating. And quite a few of these guys have died. And they're still fighting for medical care, and hopefully they'll get it, but it doesn't, you know, there's been bills that have been passed through and trying to get everything done, but it doesn't get done. Jim, are you there with us by chance yet? Kevin? Denise, are you there? Okay. I guess we're on my own tonight. Well, so far, hopefully our guests, hopefully they're going to be able to call in and join us. Well, when all this stuff started happening, it got to be very frightening. And so we're looking at all this stuff, trying to understand what happened. As we talked to the police and the fire that were in the rescues and looking at the photographs of the tower that day and everything else, there were no fires in the stairwells. There was no fires in the elevators. Again, this was all on the upper floors. We've already had previous explosions down in the sub-basement. And one of the things that, as they look at it afterwards, and again, they verified the explosions happened before either aircraft happened because, again, we're looking at the seismograph activity and everything else, so that was all picked up. And, again, this was discussed last week at the Urbana Public Library during the symposium for the Midwest on 911, asking all the questions. Well, then as they went on up in there and Willie is doing the rescues, they get the police and the fire. They had to go up in there, obviously. But the police and the fire and the firemen were carrying all of their rescue equipment. And basically, Scott air packs and everything. Well, obviously, climbing up and down the stairwells, you're not going to get very far up or down with all of this additional 50 and 60 pounds of equipment. So they finally did discard their stuff so they can get up into the towers and start getting the people out. Well, one of the things I'd like to read right now, and this is a play that Willie Rodriguez and I wrote, so one short one-act play that we wrote. And there was a request in the Army Times a couple of years ago, right on the anniversary, asking for a play about this. So Willie and I sat down and figured out we need to do something here. So this is called Reverse Triage and Depth in the North Tower. And myself and Willie Rodriguez is the authors. And so there's various characters in here. I'll attempt to change my voice a little bit as we go. The cast is Matt. He's the lead janitor in the World Trade Center North Tower, responsible for stairwells, entrances, exits, basement, maintenance areas. Matt is in reality Willie Rodriguez, the hero of the World Trade Center tragedy and co-author of this play. Jim is assistant janitor in the World Trade Center North Tower, responsible for stairwells, entrances, exits, basement areas. Mike is a World Trade Center North Tower building maintenance worker, and Mike is actually Filippi. And Filippi is the first casualty of the explosions down in the sub-basement at the time of all this stuff happening. We got firemen 1, 2, and 3. We got Susan, who's a World Trade Center corporate employee. Karen is another World Trade Center corporate employee. And Captain Lind is one of the U.S. Army officers who developed and taught the original WMD course, the New York Police and Fire Department Emergency Services Unit, for the U.S. Army at the U.S. Army Chemical School at Fort McClellan, Alabama. And that was myself. So what this play opens up with is a lit is Matt and Jim and Matt's janitorial office in the basement of the North Tower on the morning of September 11th. Matt, good morning. Jim, I expect to see you a lot earlier. Matt, I got up late, just couldn't get going. Jim, do you want to go up top for the breakfast? Matt, nah, I need to start cleaning the steps. Sounds from an explosion and the floor shakes. Jim, what was that? Matt, it's below us. Let's go find out. Jim and Matt run down the stairs to the sub-basement. They open the door to find a scene out of a combat zone. Matt, Mike is hurt. There was an explosion of some type. Call 911 and get the police and the fire department with an ambulance here now. Jim calls 911 for help. Matt and Jim do some basic first aid on Mike's burns and cuts to take him up to the loading dock of the North Tower, and the New York Fire Department ambulance and police fire guys meet them at the dock. As they load Mike onto the ambulance, there is a loud explosion and a fireball above them. They look up to see that an airplane has hit the North Tower. Jim, damn, now what? Several minutes go by as more police and fire get to the building. Matt, let's go. We got to help people. We know too many of them. Jim, you're crazy. Let the police and the fire department handle it. Matt, they do not know what the building or have the master key like I do. Jim leaves. A New York Fire Department number one. We are going up to help. Matt, we have to take the stairs. The elevators are not going to work. Matt leads the fire department guys up the stairwell and starts open doors and get folks out and down the stairs to get out of the building. A bunch of folks start going down on their own. Fireman number two, these stairs are going to get jammed real fast. What can we do? Fireman number three, when we went through the Army WMD course and field exercise at Fort McClellan, Captain Lynn talked about reverse triage. He said, do not try to move those who can't walk by themselves. He told us, don't waste time on those that are hurt real bad. Matt, I understand, but as they get up to the fourth floor, the firemen are worn out. They're wearing their full bunker gear with their Scott air packs. Fireman number two, I'm getting beat lugging all this stuff up the stairs. Matt, take it off. There's no fire in the stairwells, and we need to go up, open all these doors, help those we can get out. Matt opens the door to the fifth floor, and they go on in. Fireman number three, hey, there's a lady with crutches. Susan, I broke my ankle. I can't climb the stairs. How am I supposed to get down? The elevators aren't working. Fireman number two, you'll be okay. Just stay here for now. Susan, okay, well, how about Karen? She's 7.5 months pregnant. That's her over there. Karen, I'm okay. I can't use the stairs either. Fireman number three, both of you stay put. We'll be back. Susan and Karen, thanks. Others, fifth floor leaving, go on down the stairs. Matt, we got to keep going up and opening doors. Not all the floors have people on. Some are empty for remodeling. Now, they keep going up, helping people and directing them down the stairs and telling us they can't use steps to stay put for now. Fireman number three, we are leaving a lot of people on the floors who can't use steps. I don't feel good about this at all. Fireman number one, Matt answers one, we don't have any choice. If we start trying to help some up who can't walk down the steps, we're going to create a traffic jam and stop others from getting down and getting worn out ourselves. As we reach the 40th floor, they hear lots of noises, but not from people. Fireman, what's on this floor? What's all that noise? Matt, shouldn't be any noise on this floor. It's empty for remodeling. Hey, I'm going back down to see how folks are doing getting down now. I'll be right back. I run up and down the stairwells all day long. Fireman number two, wait for me. I'll go with you. Fireman number one, number three, keep going up while Matt and fireman number two start down. Fireman number one, number three, keep opening doors and send people down. We'll leave some to sit and wait. Matt and fireman number two are almost down to the ground floor helping kids get out when suddenly they hear muffled explosions from high up in the North Tower. Matt screaming, get out, get out, get out. Fireman number two, I've got to get back up to help. Matt, no, get out now. Fireman number two runs back up the stairs while Matt runs for the door. As Matt gets outside, he hears explosion after explosion as the building starts to crumble down. Matt sees other firemen and people running out, but remembers his buddies, fireman number one, number two, and number three are still in there somewhere in the building. Matt runs out the door and dives under a fire truck parked right outside the door. The North Tower collapses when Matt's under the big truck as the only minor cuts and bruises. Several hours later, Matt is rescued from under the truck. Lots of World Trade Center employees, firemen, and policemen die as a building collapses in a pile of dust and rubble. Jim had seen Matt rush out and dive under the truck, and the building came down so he knew where he was. Jim: Matt, I'm glad you're alive, but thousands have died. Matt: I got lucky to get out, but hey, you saw me dive under the truck. Thank you. Time goes by, and then one day, Matt and Captain Lynn happen to be speaking at events of 911 in the same place at the same time at a conference in California. Captain Lynn: Matt, I heard you were in the World Trade Center in North Tower, my former students in North Fire Department, guys 1, 2, and 3. Matt: Yes. Do you know they died trying to help folks getting out? Captain Lynn: I cried and I still cry. Some of my students from New York Police Department, Fire Department, Service Unit did get out of the building before it collapsed. Even though they are sick, they are alive. Matt: They said you taught them what they call reverse triage. Captain Lynn: Yes, you can't create a traffic jam and waste time on those who can't help themselves, or will stop you from getting helping dozens while you try to help just one or two. Matt: We didn't even think about the building collapsing in rubble as explosions went off floor by floor. Thousands died. Captain Lynn: Nobody could have known what happened, Matt. Matt: I still have nightmares about those we left and told to sit tight because it would be safe. Captain Lynn: Matt, you always will, but if you had tried to take one or more down, you could not climb on their own. More would have died. Matt: I know it, but it hurts. It really hurts. Matt and Captain Lynn embrace in friendship and memory of those who died and lived the end. Jim, have you been able to join us yet? Kevin? Okay. Well, that's kind of the things that have happening in the World Trade Center. When they looked at all the stuff, one of the things that was claimed supposedly is all of the floors collapsed one by one and came on down due to the fires. But you had consumed fires, and the fuel up there was pretty much out. There was no fires in the stairwells or the elevators. And the fuel burning is not going to get at high enough temperatures to cause steel to melt. So that's one of the things that we've known has been discussed quite a bit. But again, everybody seems to avoid looking at this. So incredible, incredible stuff that happened. The other thing, too, is real interesting. Both of these towers, again, when the second aircraft hit the second tower, again, very similar thing. Both of these towers came down within minutes after the, you know, impact, less than an hour. And there was no sufficient fires in there. I mean, one of the things that we've looked at, again, is coming back to look at things. There was a, Life put out a book called One Nation, America Remembers September 11, 2001, 10 years later. And as I look at the book, it shows Willie and the guys doing the rescues, the police and the fire doing the rescues in the stairwells and everything else with no structural damage and no fires and anything. And so some of these guys are guys that did die. You got other people that are getting out of the building, and all the building comes on down. And so, I mean, this is a horrific event that happened all the way through on everything that we're looking at. The other thing, too, that got real interesting about 911, and this is something that seems to be avoided in discussion, is building number 7. When we look at the news reports later on that day in the BBC reported that building number 7 had already come down, and building number 7, you can pull this up and look at it, was still standing. Building 7 did come down, you know, about 20 minutes or 30 minutes after the first report that it was already gone, and it was still standing, and it also came down within a few minutes. Very interesting thing is there were no fires or anything in building 7 to cause any of the structural damage that allowed this thing to come down in seconds. And the thing also came down, when you look at the video, came down into a giant heap within, you know, within free fall velocities. So all this stuff is just staggering to think about all the stuff that happened and how many people want to avoid talking about it or thinking about this.
Hey, Doug. Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, it's Kevin. I finally got through. I've been trying to call in for half an hour, and someone finally picked up the phone.
Yeah, well, Kevin, I'm glad you could join us. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad to introduce Kevin Barrett. Kevin Barrett's also been studying the World Trade Center and all the events on 911 for a long, long time. Kevin, thank you for calling in, and thank you for coming down to Champaign, Urbana, Illinois last weekend.
Well, it was great to see you. It was a very good event, and I appreciate folks who have the courage to try to look these kinds of what I guess W.C. Field said, you take the bull by the tail and look the facts in the face.
Doug, it's Jim Fetzer. I've also been calling in, but finally succeeded in reaching you, too.
Well, Jim, welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Fetzer. Jim, you're actually a U.S. Marine, aren't you, sir?
Yes, I was a captain when I resigned my commission in 1966 to enter graduate school to pursue a Ph.D. in the history and the philosophy of science.
Wow, that's an incredible. So, I mean, once a Marine, always a Marine, correct, sir?
Yes, well, I think that's true. Semper Fidelis.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Kevin, I don't know, were you ever in the military or have any military connection, Kevin?
No, I'm just a veteran of the 9/11 truth wars.
Yeah, you've been working on it for a long time. Well, you know, we've had a lot of conversations, and I opened up a little bit here with what has happened. You know, I talked about Willie Rodriguez and the fact that explosions had happened before either aircraft had. And, Jim, I mean, you have the actual documents where they did the earthquake monitoring, didn't you, where they showed the explosions happening?
Gordon Ross and Craig Furlong, who were members of Scholars, did extensive research. They've actually revised their study a couple of times. It's easily found online. It's entitled Seismic Proof, 9/11 Was an Inside Job, whereby comparing the official data from the 9/11 commission and radar of the time at which the planes allegedly impacted the building with the seismological data obtained by Columbia University's Lamont Laboratory, they were able to establish that those events, the explosions in the sub-basement, occurred 14 and 17 seconds before the alleged impacts of the planes on the buildings.
Yeah, some indication, I mean, there is, as a study, and everybody, and the architects and engineers believe that those explosions were placed in there to disable all the water supply to prevent the sprinkler systems from working. Is that correct?
Well, that was my inference, not theirs. I've never heard them address it, frankly. I've never heard them address who is responsible or why. I've never heard them address the explosions prior to the alleged impact of the plane. I've never heard them address the fabrication of all four of the crash sites. In my opinion, Doug, A&E falls miserably short of covering all of the aspects of 9/11 that the public is entitled to know.
Yeah, I think it, to me, is really frightening because, you know, when I come back and I know you and I have had the opportunity to meet a lot of these individuals involved in this stuff. But one thing that bothers me so much is, again, when we go into the actual 911 commission report, now I know personally from my own firsthand experience and involvement that all the invasion plans for going into Iraq were put in place way before, back in the 90s, and that the invasion going to Afghanistan actually came from a February 12th of 1998 directive to go in there to overthrow the Taliban because of the Unocal pipeline. So we've got all of this stuff underlying what happened. But on that horrible day when so many people died and everything, what is your understanding of, you know, from, again, the engineers, we looked at this incredible video at the Urbana Library last Sunday. What is your understanding of what could have led to these structures coming down at free fall velocity in just minutes?
Well, in seconds, actually. I mean, Building 7 was about 6.5 seconds, the North Tower about 11 seconds, the South 9, and that appears to be because the top three cubes of 10 floors of the South Tower tilted over to the side and was blown as one, as even Steve Jones acknowledged in his contribution to 9/11 and American Empire Experts Speak Out, of which Kevin would be a co-editor of a subsequent volume about Christians, Jews, and Muslims speaking out. And Kevin knows at least as many of the individuals active in the movement as do I, Doug. He gets around to many conferences. He had just returned from a conference in Washington, D.C., for example. So we'll want his input on this, too. But in my opinion, the architects and engineers' documentary, Explosive Evidence, is highly misleading in multiple respects. Because while they establish the existence of these little particles, these unexploded thermitic chips, as they refer to them, they don't add and explain that nanothermite does not have the explosive capacity to either even pulverize concrete, much less decimate steel. A series of studies that I did with T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer, who happens to work for NASA, but his research on this has nothing to do with his affiliation with that agency, discovered that it's a law of material science that in order to destroy a material, you must, an explosive must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. The speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, in steel, 6,100 meters per second. But the highest attributed detonation velocity of random thermite in the scientific literature is only 895 meters per second. That means you can't get there from there.
It sounds like what I'm picking up on from what my studies and talking to individuals, we have numerous multiple events happening all over through this whole thing to bring this whole tower, to pulverize concrete down to dust, to take steel beams and other things, just totally destroy them and everything. I mean, it's just massive, massive explosive capability, because if we just had pancaking, then there's never, my understanding, there's never been a structure, a skyscraper that's collapsed and pancaked down on itself just due to fires, has there?
In world history, it's never happened, which is part of the, you know, incredulity with which these reports have been met by anyone who understands the nature of steel structure, high rises. In the case of the Building 7, of course, we had this 47-story building that did undergo a collapse. All the floors are coming down at the same time. And when it's over, there's a pile of debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original, in this case about 5.5 floors. In the case of the Twin Towers, however, they're clearly being subjected to a completely different mode of demolition. They're blowing apart in every direction from the top down. All the floors remain stationary, awaiting their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in the memorable phrase of Morgan Reynolds. The buildings are being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. And when it's over, Doug, remarkably enough, there's no pile of debris whatsoever. In fact, as Father Frank Morales, a first responder from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, explained to me on two different occasions when I interviewed him on previous radio shows of mine, they were destroyed below ground level.
That's fascinating. I mean, when we look at this whole thing, and I'm looking at pictures and videos and everything, we've all looked at this stuff, and what you're talking about is just accurate. Kevin, you guys are both of you guys are professors. You've studied, you've taught for many years. You've looked at the military. I mean, Jim, you're a U.S. Marine, once a Marine, always a Marine. Why do you think so many individuals and so many of us have been afraid to look at the actual events on 9/11 and face the facts that seem to add up to a nightmare?
Well, I think the experts that did this were not just the controlled demolition experts who took down the three tallest buildings that have ever been taken down in any kind of controlled demolitions, and did it in a deceptive way to make the towers explode with his shock and awe. But there were also psychological warfare experts who had done lots and lots of studies about how to manipulate people's emotions and thoughts at the unconscious level. So this was an example of shock and awe, and it inculcated people with fear at a very primal level. And so the shocking fear effect sort of made people feel like they were seeing something they'd never seen before. They didn't know how to categorize it, and so it kind of shook people loose from their normal psychological moorings. And this is the first stage in what the psychological warfare experts call coercion. You shake the target person loose from their psychological moorings, and this is what torturers do, of course, when they're using torture for brainwashing. And then you reduce the person to a sort of infantile state. You regress them to a childish kind of state where they're dependent on the voice of authority. And then you step in as the voice of authority and tell them what to think and how to think. And that's exactly what was done on September 11th. The shock and awe of these people-eating clouds chasing people down the streets of New York terrorized people and shook them loose from their psychological moorings. And then the voice of authority in the form of the media and the politicians immediately began chanting in unison, "Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden." And at that point, people were just brainwashed at an unconscious level. And emotionally, once that kind of imprint has been formed on someone's mind when it's in this state of shock, it's virtually impossible to remove. It's sort of like when a baby duck sees something, like if it sees a person before it sees a mother duck, it will follow the person around. It thinks it's its mother. And no matter how loud the mother duck comes and quacks, the baby duck is still going to just follow the person around because it's been imprinted at this very deep level. And in the same way, the official version that was forced down people's throats by the media and the lying politicians in a very premeditated, very carefully pre-orchestrated way has been shoved deep into the brains of many of the American people. And they are just unable to look at the evidence and think rationally about this event.
You know, and the perps made a very clever move, Doug, by the sanctification of the official account of 19 Islamic terrorists hijacking 4 commercial carriers, outfoxing the most sophisticated air defense system in the world, and perpetrating these atrocities under the command of a guy in a cave off in Afghanistan by holding an event at the National Cathedral that was accompanied by a rabbi, a priest, and a minister, where George Bush, the then president, basically announced that the official account had the imprimatur of God. That was what he was seeking to imply. And let us not be dissuaded by outrageous conspiracy theories, where it turns out the most outrageous and easily refuted conspiracy theory is the government's own account.
You know, I'm looking at, you know, we had the events in the World Trade Center. We also had the events at the Pentagon where they claimed an aircraft came in. And I'm looking at not only the actual official report, the Pentagon Building Performance Report, but I'm looking at all the other photos and videos. I'm looking at a photo right now. And what we see, this is the fire trucks and the firemen are still there. The upper floors have just collapsed. There's literally no wreckage or no damage on the front lawn in front of the Pentagon. The construction fence that was out there is still standing. You had spools and vehicles out there from construction that were not even damaged. And when you look at the 4 floors to the left side, which is the north side of the entrance where it came on down, there's not even any fires. I mean, books are still on the desks and everything, and nothing had burned. It's almost like it was a clear shear from explosions placed in to bring that down. And then when you look at transpiring on back, you got a very small hole at about 12 feet up where a 750, the aircraft they claim in there is something like 44 foot high. It's got 150 foot wingspan and 140 foot long. You can't put this into a small hole, can you?
Yeah, it's 155 feet long. It has a wingspan that's 125 feet wide, and it has a tail that stands 44 feet above the ground. And while there are photographs showing us some kind of damage on the second floor, allegedly the plane hit on the ground floor. Its engines hang down so low, Doug, they would have had to dug massive furrows in the ground. There are no such massive furrows. In fact, the official trajectory, flying over 500 miles an hour, barely skimming the ground, is not even aerodynamically possible because of what's known as ground effect, which is the accumulation of a pocket of compressed gas beneath the fuselage. I've discussed this with aeronautical engineers who have explained to me that plane at that speed could not have gotten closer than 60 feet to the ground. That would be one wingspan, or even 80, which would be higher than the Pentagon is tall. And, of course, the idea that it hit a series of lampposts traveling at that speed, by Newton's third law, we know that the effects of a plane traveling 500 miles an hour hitting stationary lampposts is the same as if the plane had been stationary, hit by lampposts traveling 500 miles an hour. They would have fractured the wing. The fuel inside would have exploded. It would have cartwheels, tail broken off. Massive debris across the lawn, none of which occurred. So we know the official account is neither aerodynamically nor physically possible. I can't believe anyone would continue to support it.
Yeah, well, when you look, I'm looking at the photograph of the Pentagon, and this is just, while it's happening, it's still coming down. The windows aren't even broken, and the inner ring, the windows are intact on the upper floors. And so you've got a very small thing where, you know, the tail section, nothing, there was no impact, no engines. No, nothing, no wreckage or anything else.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, at the impact point, which is about 10 feet high and 16 or 17 feet wide, there's a chain link fence. There are 2 enormous spools of cable, a couple automobiles, unbroken windows, no massive pile of debris from a 100-ton airliner, no wings, no tail, no bodies, no seats, no luggage, Doug, not even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, recovered from the Pentagon. I mean, how outrageous is that?
I'm looking at a photograph while our friends of the fire department is out there on the lawn. The upper floors are still totally intact, okay? You got some fire down at the lower floors, basically on the second floor as I'm looking at. They got the fire trucks out there. The firemen are out in the front. There's no lawn damage. There's no wreckage. There's no nothing. The fence is totally intact, standing about 6 feet high. And yet behind the fence, as we said, right between the right around the second floor is where the impact was. And it's a very small hole. There's no indication of any wings on the air on the structure. There's no indication of any engines hitting the structure. And the firemen are standing out there on the undamaged lawn. When I look at this, this is all for ladies and gentlemen. This is actually photographs are in the building Pentagon Building Performance Report. So it's astonishing because if anybody does a photo analysis, even of the photos in the official report, the whole story falls apart, doesn't it, Jim and Kevin?
Yeah, you know, Doug, one way of thinking about this is, you know, there is a debate, or what passes for a debate among a few people in the 9/11 Truth Movement who've tried to make the case that, well, it's conceivable that a big plane could have hit the Pentagon this way. And when they try to make that argument, they have to really push all the parameters and bend them maybe until they break. But one way to think about it is, you know, if anybody tells you that, well, maybe if this plane was in a steep enough dive, there wouldn't have been ground effect and blah, 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 you know, it could have just done what they said it did. Well, maybe. If you look closely enough at it, that's not very credible. But another way of thinking about it is that if that were correct, then the plane would have been in this incredibly unlikely sort of pocket between where it would have just, you know, plowed into the wall in a normal way and where it would have hit the ground on the way in. Instead, this plane supposedly goes into hits the first floor and then doesn't dig up the lawn. Now, to hit the first floor and not dig up the lawn, you know, the chances of doing that are one in a million. And in fact, the chances that any hijacked aircraft would attack the Pentagon with its trajectory are less than one in a million, because it's completely insane. The trajectory that we're told about is this plane supposedly did an amazing stunt maneuver with standing G-forces that probably people couldn't even withstand in this very steep dive, twisting dive to come in on that ground level and hit the newly reinforced wing of the Pentagon that was largely vacant when they could have just taken a dive right into the middle of the building and killed thousands of people. If they'd hit the other side in a dive into the middle of the building, they could have killed thousands of top brass, including Rumsfeld. So the idea that actual terrorist hijackers would do this and be capable of doing this is completely ridiculous. And the odds that it was a big plane are you know, one in a pretty large number.
Well, as a philosopher of science, I had observed that violations of the laws of physics, chemistry, biology, aerodynamics, etc., technically qualifies miracle. Laws of nature cannot be violated. They cannot be changed. So that in order to accept the official account, you have to believe in miracles. It's that bad. It's not a matter of improbability. We're talking about physical, aerodynamic impossibility. So, Doug, anyone who's trying to advocate that some plane actually hit the Pentagon, it seems to me, is up against it, because you know, it's like changing water into wine or parting the Red Sea. These are not naturally occurring phenomena.
I'm looking at figure 3.12 in the Pentagon Building Performance Report, and these two, well, it's 3.11 and 3.12. This is in the official report. This is showing the upper floor is coming down on dust. The firemen and the fire truck are in front. They're standing outside the building. No lawn damage, no wreckage, no nothing. So, I mean, here's in the official report, the Pentagon Building Performance Report, anybody can pull up on the Internet, and again, you know, it just comes out and told us the whole thing. What was interesting for me, I was told by a member of the 911 Commission report when I asked him, he said, well, the entire tail section of the aircraft was laying out there the next day. And I'm going, okay, prove it to me.
But well, it's just a lie. I mean, words are cheap, and it's easy to lie, and it can be complex to explain why a claim a person is making is a lie, but that's an obvious absurdity there. By the way, I might mention that this event was, of course, the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference. Steve Francis, who sponsored the event, and I have been working on the videos for the event, and we expect to have them up tomorrow in three parts. So part one will be the introduction, including by Kevin, and explosive evidence, the approximately one-hour long version of the A&E documentary. Part two will be my critique of the A&E documentary and my explanation of what happened at 9/11, what the latest scientific results tell us, including, of course, about the fakery and fabrication of all four of the crash sites. And then part three will be Wayne giving his Madsen giving his explanation about three assassinations that appear to be closely related to the cover-up of 9/11. I really appreciate your remarks, Doug, at the end of part two, which are included in the video that should be up tomorrow, about why this was going on in order to instill fear into the American people to transform our foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, the United States never attacked any nation that hadn't attacked us first, into one that became an aggressor nation. Within three weeks of 9/11, we launched an invasion of Afghanistan, and, of course, where, in addition, there was a transformation of the Constitution by way of the Patriot Act, where when Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy wanted to hold hearings about it, they were subjected to anthrax attacks, which actually meant the whole Patriot Act, this massive, complicated bill, subverting the Bill of Rights, passed without a single member of Congress having actually read it.
You know, the actual, you know, what I call the Patriot Act, this actually goes back to 1996. They were actually what's called Presidential Decision Directives number 39 and number 62, written by Clinton and Gore and Reno. So that's where we first commented. You know, when I look at everything, one of the most interesting things, and again, going back to my old buddies here, on the actual 911 Commission report, I look at page 336, and quote, Franks told us that he was pushing independently to do more robust planning on military responses in Iraq during the summer before 911, a request President Bush denied, an argument at the time was not right. CENTCOM also began dusting off the plan for the full invasion of Iraq during this period, Franks said, end quote. Well, yeah, I was involved in writing them, so we knew that that was all there. And, in fact, back in the summer of 2000, I was with the 101st Airborne at Port Polk, Louisiana, where we deployed the 101st, and we got ready to go over for the initial invasion of Iraq. They got then kibosh got put onto it until a later date. You know, I mean, the whole picture just stinks to high heaven.
Kevin, do you have any doubt that the... You know, 9/11 was a construct motivated by the project for the new American century and the desire to deconstruct the modern, sophisticated Arab state so that Israel would have uncontested domination of the Middle East?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a matter of exactly just modern and sophisticated, although I think that's part of it. But, yeah, I think the Israelis have been trying to bust up the neighborhood. The Oded Yanon plan from the 1970s set out this doctrine that the Israelis were going to work to split up Arab countries into smaller units based on ethnic and sectarian lines. Bernard Lewis published an article in Foreign Affairs supporting this strategy, and then he invented the phrase the clash of civilizations, which became the basis of this war on terror ideology, which was created at the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism in 1979. Lewis was a participant, and he did the keynote essay for Netanyahu's volume of papers that came out of that Jerusalem Conference on Terrorism. So 79 was when the Israelis summoned American foreign policy experts over to Jerusalem under the command of Netanyahu and essentially set out the strategy for a long-term war against Israel's neighbors under the deceptive title of the so-called War on Terror. And so it's been a long-term project, and I'm sure 9/11 was planned for quite a long time. I think it's primarily a Zionist project, but I think there are also forces here in the U.S. that are authoritarian. These are people who, like the followers of Leo Strauss, don't like the American Constitution. They don't like democratic republicanism. They believe in authoritarianism. They're great foreign policy thinkers are Machiavelli and Hobbes, people who believe in deception and brute force. And so these people have always hated the way that the U.S. is too chaotic and democratic, and people like Rumsfeld and Cheney have been working overtime since they were together in the Gerald Ford administration to set up a secret emergency government that would one day sort of rise up from the underground missile silos where they've been having their meetings ever since the 1970s to take over. And that's what they did on 9/11. So it was a very long-planned event with two major components. One was to inflict a kind of emergency authoritarian government on the U.S., and then secondly, to make the Middle East safe for Israel by destroying Middle Eastern countries.
Well, you know, we come on back, and I'm going to go back again looking at Afghanistan, and I'm looking at the congressional report. This is February 12th of 1998. U.S. interests in the Central Asian Republics, hearing before a subcommittee on Asia, the Pacific, and the Committee on International Relations, the House of Representatives. It's a long, it's a conversation in Congress about what they need to do. But what led all this stuff, and again, this is where I came into play in understanding the other thing, quote, last October, the Central Asia Gas Pipeline Consortium called CENTGAS, in which Unocal holds an interest, was formed to develop a gas pipeline which will link the Turkmenistan's Bas Dataput gas field with markets in Pakistan and possibly India. The proposed 790-mile pipeline will open up new markets for this gas, traveling from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan to Multan in Pakistan. The proposed extension would move gas onto New Delhi, where to connect with the existing pipeline. As for a proposed Central Asia oil pipeline, CENTGAS cannot begin construction until internationally recognized Afghanistan government is in place, end quote. Well, that's where we had to go in and overthrow the Taliban and put our puppet government in there. But now what we're seeing, and this is even more frightening because it all ties together, we have the whole thing with the pipeline coming through against Syria, where we turn Syria upside down and everything else, and again, to get this totally destabilized. And it frightens me because the entire Middle East could go up in smoke in a heartbeat, couldn't it?
Yeah, it's, and of course it's the U.S. and Israel and the Saudis that are pushing it. They're trying to put that pipeline through Syria, and to do that they want to knock out Assad, who's an ally of the Russians. You see, the Iranians, the Russians, and Syria are all kind of on the same side. Russia supplies a lot of the natural gas to Europe, and here the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, Qatar are trying to break into that racket, and so they want to destroy Syria, put a pipeline through Syria to Turkey, and that's why they've got Turkey in on the game. So again, it is pipeline politics, just like with Afghanistan. It didn't work so well in Afghanistan, by the way. That project bogged down. The only real business in Afghanistan these days is the heroin business.
Very interesting. What did both, you know, all your work and everything else, we got about 10 minutes left. How can we get the American public to wake up to this? I mean, you know, as a military officer, I was terrified to have to look at this. And as I realized what happened and talked to my friends who were involved, obviously became very rapidly obvious to me that what we were told officially is not what happened at all. And what we were shown officially is not what happened at all. How do we get the American public to wake up?
Well, I think it's a long-term project. We have to keep chipping away at it. One of the most encouraging things that's been happening recently is the spread of the false flag meme. Before 9/11, hardly anybody except professional military strategists had ever heard of the concept of a false flag attack. Today, we have everyone from Ron Paul to Rand Paul to Pat Buchanan to even Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, all of them calling this event in Ghouta in Syria, this gas event, a false flag attack, because it was obviously not done by Assad, who would have absolutely no reason to launch that kind of attack just when the UN inspectors were landing. And all the evidence that's come in since then has shown that it was indeed a false flag attack. And all of these well-known Americans are now speaking out about false flags. Seymour Hersh recently just spoke out and called the alleged killing of Osama bin Laden a big lie, of which not a single word is true. So I think more and more of these well-known figures are starting to call a spade, and a false flag a false flag. The media is playing catch-up now, trying to put out articles like, what is a false flag attack? And why are people saying this about Boston? Was a big corporate-controlled media article back after Boston happened. And so I think that we need to push this false flag meme. It seems like every time a big spectacular event happens that's being manipulated politically for one reason or another, you know, Sandy Hook with a big pro-gun control PR campaign, is this alleged Islamic terrorism that pushes the U.S. to go into these wars for Israel, alleged Syrian gas that would be a perfect excuse for a U.S. attack on Syria. Every time these kinds of spectacular events happen with an obvious political agenda attached to them, we have to just spread that meme, probable false flag attack, immediately. In fact, we have to basically assume that all such events are false flags and that the burden of proof is on those who would try to tell us the contrary.
Now, Jim, I back in the 60s got involved in the military, and Vietnam was the height of everything. And I distinctly remember it's been proved the fact that our total involvement in getting us into Vietnam was the fact that the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened. And we know today the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a total black plague, totally manufactured between McNamara and Johnson.
Sure, there's a whole history here. I mean, Lyndon would later say, for all he knew, they were shooting at whales out there. I think this Seymour Hersh event is actually very significant. It's a camel getting its nose under the tent. I mean, Osama actually died on or about 15 December 2001. David Ray Griffin has a book about it entitled Osama Bin Laden Dead or Alive. Nick Kohlerstrom, who's an expert on the 7/7 London subway attacks, has an article about it, Osama Bin Laden 1957 to 2001. I have published about it repeatedly, including in relation to the film Zero Dark 40, The Deeper, Darker Truths, where you can read about it. But it's fascinating to realize that actually Fox News on 26 December 2001 announced that Osama bin Laden was dead and that had been reported in local newspapers. You can still find that article online.
Well, you know, let's come back to the World Trade Center. I mean, obviously those buildings came down within seconds. We know there was no substantial fire in the elevators or the stairwells. We know that for a fact. The photos are there. Even their own reports totally confirm all that. What do you suspect, or how can we lead, again, the thinking process, critical thinking processes, for all the military that are listening or anybody is thinking, what possible types of weapons or explosives could have been used to bring down massive structures, three of the biggest structures in America, within seconds? I mean, obviously, you know, it's not just a conventional hand grenade or some thermite to thermite that cuts a beam that doesn't pulverize everything else. What's happening here, and how do we get people to think about reality?
Well, you know, Jim and I actually have kind of agreed on this. Jim already gave us his reasons for thinking that the architects and engineers have not quite gone all the way with the evidence that's out there. And I guess I would tend to agree with Jim, generally at least, that while there may have been this thermite cutter charges, incendiaries that cut the steel, at the same time that the steel pillars were being cut so that the columns were cut so that the building wouldn't be standing up anymore, some kind of agent was used to pulverize the concrete and to that explosively ejected huge chunks of steel out of the building, upwards and outwards. So there were probably these thermite cutter charges that sliced the steel, and there was probably something explosive. And I think Jim has concluded that the evidence supports the use of miniature nuclear weapons that would have pulverized the building floor by floor from the top down. I suppose conventional explosives might have done the same kind of job. Is that right, Jim?
Well, no, conventional explosives, Kevin, would have left a massive pile of debris. You know, I mean, the fact is these buildings were destroyed below ground level. Now, what we find is that the U.S. Geological Survey gathered massive dust samples from all over the city, dozens of locations, so that while architects and engineers appeal to contents of the dust sample, they ignore the fact that these dust samples are far more revealing than they allow, including barium and strontium, thorium and uranium, lithium, lanthanum, yttrium, chromium, tritium. These are all elements, Doug, that would not be present had this not been a nuclear event. These mini or micro neutron bombs can virtually be dialed for their radius of destruction. So if you had them loaded in the elevator shafts where Ace Elevator Company was conducting what they claimed to be the largest elevator renovation in history, they would have had suitable access to situate them. If you give them an explosive radius of 100 feet, say, the towers were 208 feet on a side, so you're pretty much destroying the all of the tower or that part of the tower where that particular device is located. There are different ways they might have been arranged. I have suggested as one illustration putting them in place so they take out one cube of 10 floors per second. And then since we had the North Tower, all 110 stories standing, if you took out one cube of 10 floors per second, that would take 11 seconds, which corresponds to NIST's own finding. The North Tower, because the top three floors tilted to one to the side and were taken out as 19 seconds, but that's only one possible arrangement. The fact is that the dust evidence that architects and engineers have emphasized is the most important evidence, but it's the part they don't talk about. It's all these other elements, the barium, strontium, thorium, uranium. In fact, I'm dumbfounded that they could create the impression that they've done a thorough study of the dust, and all they've come up with is
Jim, we need to plug
chips.
Our book.
Well, our music is coming up.
There's so much more there to be found in the dust.
Yeah, we have a new book out there. It's about us. It's called Dynamic Duo, A White Rose Blooms in Wisconsin, from CWGPress.com.
Well, our music is coming up. Jim, Kevin, thank you very much. Thank you for all the work trying to get the truth out. We need to continue the conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, Warrior Connection does provide you information. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward. We want you to look, want you to see, want you to think. The information, the documentation is out there, as we've discussed. We'll continue this conversation. Jim, Kevin, thank you. God bless you. Thank you very much, both of you, for all your work.
Thanks,
our great pleasure. Don, thanks for having us on.
Okay, have a good night, ladies and gentlemen, and time to think, to really, really think, and look and analyze. Have a good evening.